Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It was a unanimous vote today at the Federal Reserve. Interest rates will stay right where they are. A non-decision decision, you could call it, an indication the economy's just where the central bank wants it to be. For now, anyway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Wednesday, the 9th of May. Great to have you with us. It's now seven meetings in a row the Federal Reserve has declined to move interest rates one way or the other. Even as economic growth slows, gross domestic product slumped badly last quarter, the job market's sluggish at best, and inflation's reasonably tame. So we got Greg McBride from Bankrate.com on the phone, and we asked him, what the heck?
We're just now seeing the effects of last year's rate hikes. The Fed has wanted ample time to sit back and evaluate fully the impact of those previous rate hikes before they made any moves one way or the other.
5.25% is where the federal funds rate sits. We'll do the Fed dance all over again come the last week of June. We're used to hearing bad news from home builders. Fallout from the troubled subprime mortgage market has made it harder for would-be buyers to get loans. Others are hoping to wait out the Fed for a rate cut. So it wasn't entirely surprising today when Toll Brothers warned it won't meet its earnings target for the year. Toll Brothers builds luxury homes, though. Its customers aren't high-risk borrowers or first-time buyers. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports even the wealthy are starting to feel some pain.
Toll Brothers still expects to turn a profit for the second quarter, but it says new contracts fell by 14% from a year ago, and the value of its total contracts fell by 25%. The company blamed a lack of buyer confidence and the tighter lending requirements put in place after mortgage defaults began to soar. Analyst Greg Gieber with A.G. Edwards says the effects of the lending crunch have reached all the way up to the top-end buyers. They're canceling contracts for new houses because they can't sell the old ones.
Probably the person buying their house is going to be somebody who's also moving up from an existing house, and they'll have to sell. So you have this sort of chain that goes on. At the bottom end are first-time buyers, and they are the ones that will have trouble getting credit.
Luxury home builders are taking another hit from the exodus of speculators who helped drive prices up during the real estate boom. Kevin Harris is chief economist at Informa Global Markets. He says builders like Toll Brothers had profited from all the speculation.
People who wanted to make a lot of money in the real estate market knew they could do best at the high end because that's where prices were highest. As speculation slows down, that market is slowing down.
Harris predicts the market will get worse before it gets better as more lenders tighten their mortgage standards through the summer. For example, if customers say they make $60,000 pre-tax, bankers will now ask them to prove it. Harris says, believe it or not, even some big-name lenders weren't doing that. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Here comes one of those good news, bad news stories. Toyota reported yet another year of record profit today. That would be the good news. The bad is that those profits weren't quite as much as everybody had expected, and the company says things are going to be even slower next year. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out what's really going on with the world's soon-to-be largest automaker.
Toyota's profit grew nearly 9% in the first quarter, and its profits for the fiscal year, which ended in March, were up almost 20%. But the company's playing down its success, warning investors that profits will likely grow by a measly less than 1% in this fiscal year. Toyota's blaming the severe market in North America for its doom and gloom projections. North America accounts for more than half the company's profits. Ron Harber of Harber Consulting says consumers are worried about the general state of the economy and high gas prices and are hesitating before they buy new vehicles.
Maybe I'll just defer that decision because I've got to figure out whether this is going to last longer term or not. If it does, maybe I'll buy a different car than what I had in mind or a different truck.
He says that hesitation is affecting all car makers. Plus, some analysts say the shaky housing market means fewer contractors buying pickups and fewer homeowners refinancing to buy new cars. But consultant Michael Robinette of CSM Worldwide says Toyota's also spending a lot of money right now.
Toyota is currently launching a number of new facilities. They are expanding their portfolio into new segments, and with that comes some risks.
In any case, Toyota tends to be cautious about predicting its own success, so it could well end up beating expectations anyway. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The Senate wants the Food and Drug Administration to pay more attention to drugs after they're on the market. The vote was 93-1 today to require the FDA to come up with some kind of post-approval monitoring program. Nobody wants any more high-profile drugs to be pulled off the market. Think Merck and Vioxx here if you need. Tomorrow, an FDA panel takes up anemia medications. They're often used by cancer patients, but they're expensive for both patients and insurance companies, and perhaps for manufacturers as well. The New York Times reported today drug companies are effectively paying cancer doctors to encourage their use, and paying them a lot. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer has more.
These anemia drugs are the single biggest pharmaceutical expense for Medicare, nearly $2 billion a year. Eric Weiner from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute says they're undoubtedly overused.
Some of the overuse of these drugs probably arises from direct marketing to patients.
Weiner says it's tough to turn down cancer patients who feel lousy and see an ad telling them that this drug will make them feel better. Weiner says he doesn't know if doctors get lucrative deals to prescribe the drugs, but there should be full disclosure. Pharmaceutical analysts, though, aren't surprised by the Times allegations.
Drug companies are giving rebates to different players within the market, and it's considered to be relatively standard practice in the industry, so I wouldn't be surprised if it's true.
Morningstar's Heather Brilliant says Johnson & Johnson's anemia drug, Procrit, earns about $2 billion a year in the U.S. But that's less than 5% of J&J's revenue, so Brilliant doesn't see much impact, even if the FDA panel recommends reducing use of the drugs. More worrying, she says, is the possibility of litigation. Recent reports have shown that high doses of these drugs can increase heart attacks, stroke, and death. Meta Partners analyst Max Jacobs says biotech company Amgen's anemia drugs, Epogen and Aranesp, are really important for the company.
Epogen and Aranesp are about $6.7 billion approximately. So it's a very large proportion of their revenues.
Almost half indeed. As for generous payments to get doctors to use the drugs, Jacobs says aggressive marketing is the rule in the pharmaceutical industry. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Rupert Murdoch's the latest to jump on the global warming bandwagon. The man who would own the Wall Street Journal announced today his company, News Corp, will be carbon neutral by the end of the decade. Still nothing new to tell you about whether or not he'll actually succeed in buying the Dow Jones company. And don't get your hopes up too high for a break next time you fill up, but the Energy Department reported today the nation's gasoline reserves rose last week. That's after more than 3 months of declines. It took a while for investors to figure out how they felt about the Fed's non-decision today. In the end, they didn't feel so bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We mentioned the Federal Reserve's report on consumer credit earlier this week. Suffice it to say that on average, we're all carrying a pretty hefty balance on our plastic. It's never a pleasant thing being in debt, but owing money has recently become more of a problem for those who are chronically late with their payments. Time was when debt collectors would periodically pull your credit report just to see if anything had changed that might make it easier for them to track you down. In this electronic age, though, they don't have to do that anymore. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Long Islander Dorothea de Trinis loved to shop. She had a good job as a teacher, earning $60,000 a year. As well as buying clothes for herself, she lent money to family and splurged on gifts for her 29 nieces and nephews. $20,000 in credit card debt didn't seem so bad.
That plastic. And there is a power trip. You know, when you whip out the card, this gold card. Like, I've got the gold card, you know.
But in 2003, suffering from depression, Detrinis quit her teaching job. Later, she started working from home for a web-based marketing company. Her new bosses told her she'd need to fork out a lot in business expenses up front, but she'd earn it all back, and then some. Detrinis racked up $90,000 more on her cards before concluding the company was a scam. She tried to reach minimum payment deals with her creditors, but they quickly handed her over to debt collectors.
It became where I live home with my folks and we can't pick up the phone because we don't know if it's going to be a collector on the other end.
Some debtors may be getting more phone calls than usual thanks to a new electronic service aimed at debt collectors. It's called Collection Triggers and it's being marketed by credit bureau Experian. Here's how it works. Software mines Experian's rich trove of data on consumers. If it finds information indicating that someone's ability to pay off their debt has improved, it triggers a quick notice to debt collectors, and they pick up the phone. Joe Rideout is with the group Consumer Action. He says Experian's using odd criteria to decide whether someone is better able to make inroads into their debt.
Experian considers one of their three criteria listed, whether you have open funds on a bank card. In other words, they're encouraging people to pay one form of debt with credit card debt, and they're encouraging financial irresponsibility on the part of debtors rather than trying to help people get back on their feet.
But experienced Dan Buell doesn't see it that way. He says the company's product is perfectly legit. It abides by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which governs the way consumers' personal data can be accessed and used. And he says,
the thing to remember is that this is a valid debt that was incurred. And oftentimes, particularly in a post-judgment situation, this was a debt that was vetted with an objective third party, being the court. So this is a logistical business exchange.
An exchange between Experian and the debt collectors, he says, that lets the collectors determine which accounts are worth pursuing. Michael McAuliffe is president of the Family Credit Counseling Service and a former debt collector himself. He says he doesn't see these services as unfair, but rather as unfortunate.
Certainly unfortunate for consumers, because now consumers who are in a position to begin getting their debt back under control are going to have to really think hard and long about whether or not they're ready to do it now, when the ramifications could be every additional collector coming after them, you know, within 24 to 48 hours.
Still, he says it's natural for debt collectors to go for a service that lets them focus on debtors who are trying to make changes in their lives. In other words, consumers who are likely to pay up.
These are high commission people. Collection agencies have a very high turnover in their staff. We have people who work for us that have worked at collection agencies. One of them, you couldn't get your desk chair until you got your first check by phone for the day.
So he says any product that lets collectors home in on the money is likely to be a hit. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Martha Stewart's teaming up with the discount chain Costco. The company made the announcement this morning, along with its first quarter profit report. You'll be able to find Martha Stewart co-branded foods next time you go to the discount warehouse to stock up. Martha Stewart Living OmniMedia is counting on the deal to turn things around. It posted a wider loss of almost $12 million January through March. Except for that jail sentence for lying to investigators about a stock sale, Martha Stewart's living the dream of many an entrepreneur, coming up with a product that is so successful you take it national. There's a million of those stories in the Naked City, including one right here in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, to be exact, as Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports.
Ever since it opened up two blocks from Rodeo Drive 2 years ago, people have been clamoring for the cupcakes made at Sprinkles. It's not just that they tasted good, it's that being in the store was an experience. Eli Portnoy is a branding expert, and he saw it immediately.
This tiny, kind of very slick environment, like an expensive boutique for jewelry or handbags, presenting them in exquisite boxes, Tiffany-like.
Making something simple so fancy-schmancy is part of why people have been lining up, but so is that the something simple, this cupcake, has nostalgia on its side.
We have fantastic associations with cupcakes, you know, growing up with them. And also it's just a happy, fun pleasure. It's like ice cream or something. How can you not love a cupcake?
That's Sprinkles founder Candace Nelson. She's branched out to two other cities already and has plans to add three more by the end of the year. She's wary of becoming another Krispy Kreme too big for its britches kind of story.
Well, the thing that Krispy Kreme did that we will never do is they started selling through other channels. We have no intention of ever doing that.
Still, the expansion worries Eli Portnoy.
If you expand too fast, I think sometimes unique products lose that point of differentiation. And it's the biggest problem we have in a lot of products in this country is it's everywhere. And when something is now everywhere, gap-like, people want to move on to the next thing.
Pastry expert Chef Brian Averna doesn't think so. He studies food trends for a living, and he says cupcakes may be trendy, but there's nothing flash in the pan about them.
I don't think cupcakes are going to be gone. This is not Atkins. This is just a great way to serve a dessert.
And in an age where people pay $4 for a cup of coffee, what's $3.25 for a treat, especially if it tastes good? In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Coming up, the economics of Jamestown.
The government didn't have money to put into exploration and colonization, so every colony was founded by a joint stock company, a sort of infant corporation.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fluttered forward 53 points, 0.4% to finish the day at 13,362. The NASDAQ blushed up 4 points, 0.2% to end the day at 2576. The S&P 500 snuggled up 4 points, 0.3% to come in at 1512. Soaring commodities prices have companies in that sector looking downright dapper these days, especially to each other. Aussie mining giant Rio Tinto picked up almost 12% on rumors it's a takeover target for industry leader BHP Billiton. BHP polished up 5%, and metals maven Alcoa dipped about 2% after it made a hostile bid for industry rival Alcan. Alcan slid 2%. Bond prices fell after the Federal Reserve's rate decision. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.67%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. The Marketplace Health Desk is supported by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation working toward a high-performance health system. On the web at commonwealthfund.org. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for March. The nation's largest retailers announce sales figures for April. And the House Small Business Committee talks about the current state of immigration policy and how different proposals impact small businesses. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A month or so into the contaminated pet food story, the Chinese government has decided to take action. Today it promised inspections of livestock feed, animal medicines, and pig slaughterhouses. The FDA, meanwhile, is keeping an eye on things here because, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, there is a whole wide world of food sources out there to be worried about.
Americans are getting more of their food from overseas, $65 billion worth last year, a number that's been growing between 10 and 15% a year since 2001.
If you go to a cheesecake factory, you're going to see something from all over the planet in some kind of a fusion.
Stephanie Selesnik of the National Restaurant Association says immigration has helped spark a growing appetite for foreign cuisine.
There used to be a season when you could get fresh corn or you could get grapes. Today, you can walk into many different kinds of supermarkets and get produce that's grown all over the world.
The Food and Drug Administration inspects only 1% of food imports, not enough, according to Chris Waldrop of the Consumer Federation of America.
Right now, the FDA is sorely lacking in resources and funding to be able to ensure that all the imports that are coming in are as safe as they should be.
The food inspection budget hasn't been keeping up with the pace of imports, although the White House has asked for a significant increase in 2008. It's not just melamine and pet food that has food inspectors concerned. Asian food manufacturers routinely use additives and preservatives such as formaldehyde and cyanuric acid that have been banned in this country. Imported food can be tough to track. For example, some of the tainted Chinese pet food was fed to U.S. hogs and poultry. A group of federal agencies is putting together a more comprehensive assessment of animal exposure to the contaminated pet food that should be out by the end of the week. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Now you know that it's not safe to buy pet food from China.
Commentator David Frum.
So why do you think it's safe to put your 401k there? Hundreds of billions of dollars of investment money have flowed into China over the past 15 years. Only the United States and Great Britain now receive more foreign direct investment than China. But talk to a foreign investor in China, and you hear one terrible story after another. As one investor recently put it to me, one of two things happens to your investment. It fails, and you lose your money. Or it succeeds, and they take your money. U.S. investment in China earns surprisingly little. The most recent UN figures show that U.S.-affiliated companies earn less in China than they do in Mexico. The money continues to flow on the assumption that China's progress can only accelerate. Yet even now, well into China's third decade of economic reform, half the industrial workforce still works for state-owned enterprises. And telecoms, banking, food distribution, and energy remain government monopolies. Property rights have only begun to exist and cannot be enforced even when they do exist. Even China's keenest admirers acknowledge that virtually every large transaction requires a bribe. Economists, like Carnegie's Minchin Pai, estimate that China's corruption industry is equivalent to something between 1/20th and 1/15th of gross domestic product. And all those impressive Chinese economic growth figures ultimately rely on statistics generated by the same government that lied to the world about industrial additives in the pet food. Something real and important and possibly very positive is happening in China. Of course, something real, important, and positive happened in the dot-com world in the 1990s. Just not a happy return on equity.
David Frum is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Drop us a line with your comments about what he had to say or about anything else you hear on the program. Just go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. And a couple of more things on China today before we leave the topic. The benchmark Shanghai Composite Index hit a record today, 4,013 at the close. Investors with a recent sense of history will recall it was the Shanghai meltdown that led to Wall Street's big dip back at the end of February. And a Treasury Department official told Congress that the Bush administration is, quote, completely frustrated with Beijing on the issue of currency reform. But he said the White House is not yet ready to say China's manipulating the UN to get a trade advantage. There's a huge party down in Jamestown, Virginia this weekend. The first colony will be 400 years old on May 14th. If you don't happen to remember your 8th grade history, here's a quick refresher. The Virginia Company landed more than 100 settlers in the New World in the spring of 1607. Things didn't start off so well. The site was unhealthy. The settlement was poorly managed. And investors in the company were none too happy about it. Karen Kupperman is a history professor at New York University. She's also the author of the book, The Jamestown Project. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Was the Virginia Company successful in its initial appeal for capital from investors? I mean, how did it actually finance its operations?
It started out as a classic company of the time, that it was a very small number of highly connected investors. And at the end of 2 years, when things were going badly, instead of walking away from it, which you might have expected them to do, what they did was reorganize. And they got a new charter. They set the price of a single share at £12.10.06, which was, it's still a lot of money, but it was something that made it possible for huge numbers of people to invest.
it completely changed the whole nature of the enterprise. And I think that's more than anything responsible for its ability to hang on.
Do we see vestiges of the Virginia Company on Wall Street today and in London and in Paris and in the world's big stock markets?
Certainly the corporate form has changed. And one of the differences between a modern corporation and a joint stock company is that there was no limited liability. Every single investor was responsible for the entire debt of the company. So it was quite high risk. But I think it's also, we see vestiges in the sense that the Virginia Company was looking to the next quarterly report just like every company does today. And the problem was that the colonists, the poor beleaguered colonists, were just trying to get set up and running, and they were being bombarded with these demands to send back something of value because the investors were not prepared to keep putting in money indefinitely without any sign of returns.
As you watch the Queen coming through the States this past week and then at the White House, what thoughts ran through your mind about us 400 years later still celebrating this little speck of commerce?
Well, I think it's actually more than, I mean, I think it's a speck of commerce, but it's a particularly important speck of commerce. They first tried incredibly harsh martial law, where they were going to absolutely force everybody to go to bed together, get up together, eat together. They've regulated every aspect of life and put on the death penalty for every slight infraction. But they then gave that up and said, okay, now we understand that actually turning over control to these people, giving them a stake, giving them their 50 acres, this was the breakthrough that the company made, and it was a breakthrough that I think is of extreme importance in American history because what they ultimately decided was that only if people have a stake in the outcome are they going to behave as these social theorists wanted them to.
Karen Kupperman is Silver Professor of History at New York University. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today. Last fall, the hedge fund Amaranth Advisors imploded spectacularly, it should be said. It lost more than $6 billion worth of investors' money in the process. Amaranth had made a big bet, which turned out to be wrong, on the direction of natural gas prices. Today, what's left of the fund settled with the Securities and Exchange Commission over charges of violating securities laws. The government said Amaranth, quote, willfully violated trading rules, although not necessarily on that natural gas bet. Total fine? $716,000 after $6 billion in losses, none of which, it should be said, has stopped some of Amaranth's former executives from setting up a new hedge fund. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 53 points. That is 0.4%. Yes, another record. The Nasdaq gained 4 points, about 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, a third of 1% there. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. If you happen to miss the program on the radio, you can always check out our podcast. The link is on our homepage, marketplace.org. Next time, shopping undercover.
I usually have a little shopping list, and then in between whatever I need, I write the names of the people I interact with and make little smiley faces or the opposite.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.